Come and teach my people. Early in 1952, Babogi Nayari, a Kariari chief and prominent witch doctor, visited Henny Henny, his Wantok or fellow tribesman, and attended a meeting at his home. Impressed by what he saw and heard, Babogi later approached Tom Kiddo and pleaded, "Please, come and teach my people about the truth." Soon afterward, Tom and Rowena drove their old pickup truck over boggy dirt roads to Babogi's home at Haima, a small village about 15 miles north of Port Moresby. Tom preached to the assembled villagers while Babogi interpreted. As a result, about 30 people began studying the Bible. Later that month, the group at Haima built a small hall for Christian meetings. The hall had a bush timber frame, thatched grass roof, and waist-high plated bamboo walls, recalls Elsie Horsberg, who later attended meetings there. Sapling seats, a kerosene lamp, and a small blackboard completed the internal decor. This modest structure became the first Kingdom Hall in Papua New Guinea. Babogi then wanted his Wantoks in the nearby mountains to hear the good news too. So he and Tom set off along a precipitous mountain road to the Sagari Plateau. Soon they were studying with over 90 people in three villages there. Such activity did not escape the notice of the government authorities. At Ioadabu, a government officer marched into the meeting place, demanding to know who had authorized Jehovah's Witnesses to teach the local villagers. The police also interrogated several interested people about the nature of our work. Some village pastors and plantation owners even threatened the brothers with violence. Under such pressure, some interested ones fell away. Yet, a nucleus stood firm. In 1954, the first witness baptism in Papua New Guinea was held, and 13 Bible students were baptized in the Laloki River at Haima. One of them was Babogi, who declared, "Even if all the Koyari fall away, I will not, because I know this is the truth." True to his word, Babogi maintained his integrity, serving faithfully as an elder in the Haima congregation until his death in 1974. The following is from page 86 of the printed edition. The Wantok System. The term Wantok, meaning one talk in Tok Pisin, is related to a powerful cultural bond that links people of the same ethnic group who speak the same language. The bond includes certain obligations and privileges. For example, people are expected to care for the material needs of their elderly Wantoks, people who speak their language, or for those out of work or unable to work. This is a real help in a land with limited social welfare. The system also has its downside. For instance, when Bible students take a stand for the truth, other family members may reject them. In such situations, new ones must look to Jehovah for aid should they become unemployed or for some other reason come into material need. The Wantok system can also put brothers under considerable pressure to associate unduly with non-witness relatives, including those who may be disfellowshipped, says branch committee member Kegawa Labiyama. Also, during political elections, witness relatives of candidates are often pressured to compromise their Christian neutrality. Of course, they do not compromise. Returning to the account. Memorable gatherings. In July 1955, John Cutforth, a Canadian missionary serving in Australia, arrived in Port Moresby as the first circuit overseer. John took an immediate liking to the tropics, its way of life, and its humble people. Little did he know that he would serve in Papua New Guinea for more than 35 years. John brought with him the film The New World Society in Action, a documentary highlighting the organizational work and conventions of Jehovah's Witnesses. During his three-week visit, he showed the film 14 times to audiences ranging from a few hundred people to nearly 2,000. It had a real impact on the local population, many of whom had never seen a film before. John's visit culminated in a one-day circuit assembly at Haima. When the candidates for baptism were asked to rise, 70 stood up, recalls Tom Kiddo. Our hearts literally welled up with gratitude to see 40 brothers and 30 sisters lined up along the Jungle River, ready to symbolize their dedication to Jehovah. The following year, the brothers arranged to hold a second circuit assembly at Haima. Bobogi, the village chief, was assigned to build the needed facilities and prepare food for those expected to attend. 3 days before the assembly, John, or Ted Sewell, the new circuit overseer from Australia, met with Bobogi to discuss the preparations. "What have you built?" asked Ted, getting right to the point.
"Nothing yet," Bobogi replied.
"But this is Thursday, Bobogi, and the assembly is on Sunday," exclaimed Ted.
"That's all right, brother," answered Bobogi. "We'll make everything on Saturday."
Ted was aghast and returned to Port Moresby convinced that the assembly would be an organizational disaster. That Sunday he drove anxiously to Haima to see what had happened. What a transformation! Under a sweeping tree facing a large area of cleared ground stood a sturdy wooden podium. Farther away lay stone cooking pits where pigs, wallabies, deer, pigeons, fish, yams, and sweet potatoes were being roasted. Tea kettles boiled on an open fire. Crowds of people mingled happily at a cafeteria made from bush materials. And there, in the midst of all the activity, stood Bobogi, looking quite unperturbed. Ted was flabbergasted. "Bobogi, where did you learn to do all this?" he gasped.
"Oh, I saw all of this in that film John Cutforth showed us last year," replied Bobogi.
Over 400 people from 8 ethnic groups attended that assembly, and 73 were baptized. In later years, it came to be called Bobogi's Assembly. Preaching with Pictures. In 1957, John Cutforth moved permanently to Papua New Guinea and took up the traveling work there. Since his first visit, he had thought long and hard about the best way to preach to the local people, most of whom were illiterate. Now he was ready to put his ideas into practice. When addressing a congregation or isolated group, John first wrote his name and the name of his interpreter on a blackboard. Then, pointing to heaven, he asked the audience, "God, what name?" He wrote their answer, Jehovah, as well as Psalm 83:18 at the top of the board. Underneath, to the left, he then wrote the heading Old World and drew stick figures of two men fighting, a person crying, a grave, and Romans 5:12. On the right, he wrote the heading New World and drew two men shaking hands, a smiling face, a grave crossed out, and Revelation 21:4. Afterward, he gave an animated talk explaining the drawings. He then invited individuals in the audience to come forward and repeat his presentation. When they had mastered it, he invited them to copy the pictures onto a sheet of paper and use it in their preaching work. Picture Sermon 1, as it was called, had a profound impact on the preaching work in Papua New Guinea. Other picture sermons soon followed. We spent countless hours copying these picture sermons into school exercise books. Each Bible student received a copy, which he used to preach to others, says Lena Davison, who served in the country for 47 years. Children produced their own picture books and colored them in with great pride. This teaching method was also adapted for congregation meetings. Blackboard drawings were used extensively during the public meeting and watchtower study, greatly helping those who could not read, explains Joyce Willis, a Canadian pioneer who spent more than 40 years in Papua New Guinea. Picture sermons painted on canvas were also used as teaching aids at assemblies. These large paintings were very popular and impressed key teaching points on the mind of the audience, says Mike Fisher, who served in the circuit work there. Many of the paintings ended up hanging in the homes of isolated publishers, who proudly used them to witness to visitors. Decades later, when more people learned to read and write, and illustrated literature became widely available, picture sermons were discontinued.
The following is from page 91 of the printed edition. He won the hearts of many. During his missionary service in Papua New Guinea, John Cutforth won the hearts of many. Consider what some of his fellow missionaries and others with whom he worked had to say about him. Erna Anderson.
John told us, a true missionary becomes all things to all people. If people give you a stump to sit on it. It is the best they can give. If they give you a roughly hewn bed, sleep on it. It has been made with kindness. If they give you unusual food, eat it. It has been prepared with love. John was an outstanding example of a self-sacrificing missionary.
Awak Duvun.
During the period of colonial rule, John not only broke down prejudice between black people and white people, but destroyed it. Black man, white man, no difference, he often declared. He loved all.
Peter Linke.
One afternoon, after traveling most of the day, John arrived at our home in Goroka, dusty and tired. Yet after dinner, he said, "I haven't done anything for anyone else today," and trudged off into the failing light to visit and encourage a local family. He was always concerned about others. We all loved him.
Jim Dobbins.
John taught us to live simply and to teach simply, using illustrations that people could understand, as Jesus did. This enabled us to communicate with those who couldn't read or write.
Returning to the account. Expanding the witness. During the late 1950s, a steady stream of zealous Australians moved to Papua New Guinea, eager to preach the good news. In addition, many people who learned the truth in Port Moresby returned to their villages with the kingdom message. Thus, the good news spread rapidly throughout the country. In 1957, David Walker, a 26-year-old Australian brother living in Port Moresby, heard that people in the neighboring Manu Manu village and in the Gabadi region were interested in the truth. David left his job, started special pioneering, and spent a year preaching in the region, working alone in service the whole time. Others later built on his efforts, and now Manu Manu has a congregation and a kingdom hall. In the meantime, while preaching at Kaki Market in Port Moresby, Don Fielder met several fishermen interested in the truth. The men came from Hula, a coastal village about 60 miles to the east. To help them and their families further, Don, along with Athol or Dap Robeson and some interested Hula people, set sail for Hula in Don's new 26-foot twin-hull canoe. They stayed in Hula for 3 days and established a small study group there. Soon afterward, Don moved to Hula as a special pioneer, taking his wife Shirley and their 2-year-old daughter Debbie with him. "We built a small hut and began preaching in the 5 villages in the area," relates Don. "This involved walking a circuit of about 8 miles every day. It was physically taxing but spiritually refreshing, as we started many Bible studies and soon had 8 new publishers working along with us." Don and Shirley's preaching aroused the ire of the local United Church minister, who pressured their landlord to order their hut off his land. When people from a nearby village heard about this, they were very angry because they did not want us to leave, says Don. About 20 of them helped us to move our hut, foundations and all, to a new plot of land owned by their village. The irate clergyman refused to give up. He lobbied the Port Moresby authorities to ban the Fielders from locating their hut anywhere in the district. "Rather than leave our assignment," says Don, "we asked Alf Green, a skilled carpenter, to salvage wood from our hut and build a small room on our twin hull canoe. We then anchored the canoe in a mangrove swamp near the mouth of a nearby river. There, among swarming mosquitoes and lurking crocodiles, we lived, while pioneering, for the next 2.5 years. When their second daughter, Vicky, was born, the Fielders returned to Port Moresby. They later shared in the traveling work, and Don served on the branch committee.